Welcome back to Zero and Repeater. This is Adam from Acid Horizon, and today we're joined by poet, polemicist, and educator Tommy Sissons to talk about his new novel, Cautious, A Boat Adrift, out now on Repeater Books. We're going to be talking about the challenges of history, mythology, and narrative writing, working class history and culture as told from below, from everything to deindustrialization to the working men's club movement, and of course the temporal malaise of modern Britain under capitalist realism, with the specter of England itself haunting the working class, which Tommy of course covered in his debut book for Repeater, A Small Man's England from 2021. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure.
All right. So I know you picked out a reading from the book to start it off. And of course, in post, we will put a lovely little bit of ambient under this to really thicken the atmosphere, but whenever you're ready.
Okay. Wicked. So this is from about halfway through the book. And to place it in some context, what has happened is the main character, Fred, is reflecting on his recent relationship with an ex-girlfriend and his friendship with a guy called Dino, which has split apart. And in reflecting on what he learned from his relationship with those two people, he is applying that to his understanding of the late capitalist landscape that he exists in. So this is him talking about Dino at first. Still, I think of him when I see a menacing headline. Five signs of the rise of fascism in the British state. I went on holiday to the city of London and all I got was this shitty capitalism. This unreal, indifferent sci-fi hyper-capitalism, spacecraft capitalism, interplanetary capitalism. Can't have a bacon butty without contributing to it, capitalism. You are not as smart as you think. It is an age of the constant present. That is to say, it is the age of the non-age. Time has fallen off its linear trajectory. It is reprocessed, reproduced, and revived in infinite cycle. Time has been detemporalized. Time is not itself. I am not myself. I am not quite real. I am the sum of my productivity. I must buy more and I must sell more. My phone is a sweatshop. My work shirts are from Bangladesh. My food is faux Indian and faux Italian. My TV is Japanese. When the Euros are on, I support Brazil over England. I am very cultured. I am multinational. I am the corporation's basset hound. I read fake news regularly and secretly, deep down, enjoy sensationalism. It is a guilty pleasure. It is an escape technique. I don't like that nowadays everyone's a copper. I don't like that nowadays everyone's a snitch. I don't like how capitalism is so fucking intelligent. As for the latter takeaway from mine and Darla's relationship, I never did grow a moustache, although it is not too late. It has recently been a time of relatively little novelty. My mates wear their mullets and Chelsea cuts of their parents, third wave skins and fourth wave mods saunter to post-punk gigs in gentrified bodegas. Am I nostalgic for the past? No. Am I hopeful for the future? Double no. It seems to me that the great future society, the painted land of manifestos, is now consciously or unconsciously considered a mirage. Why? Because the future, once imagined in the time of our predecessors, has already arrived and now we see it for what it is. A detemporalized space which knows no end, for it knows no time. We who have known no different are sick of the future present. We are, then, reproduced images of the past, of our parents, of that which was never experienced, of a past present, of a stylish, nor even because it knew itself more, but because it was not this. Sometimes I think of those I grew up with and wonder if they too have had similar thoughts. Would I be able to sit and eat tea with them, or would the knives have to be confiscated first? When I first said I was a socialist, my friend Weird Craig laughed at me. He laughed all the way home to his council house and told his unemployed father, and his father laughed too. Perhaps not all of them vote Tory. A lot of them do. I imagine they too are searching for meaning in their own way, at their own pace, perhaps more successfully than me. I think of the times we knew no different kind of folk to each other and had no one to hate in any serious way. Christ, I can't even remember some of their names. Where did all the poor buggers go? There we go.
That is now the beautiful selection. I mean, it covers so many of the things we're going to cover today. I mean, especially this idea of not even this nostalgic impulse of looking back and saying things are better, but rather the fact that the past, the good parts of the past, are so incredibly dulled, or if not actively being destroyed, slaughtered by the present. And just before we jump into those themes, could you introduce actually just what seems to be the main two characters here, of course, Fred Whitby and his granddad Norman, because the book is fundamentally, you know, a conversation between both their memories, but also a conversation between them both as writers, and a conversation is present to us in the book, but it's nonetheless the present as a folding in of a future which might have been dull, or a present with a latent future in it, and the entire history of this island, and of physically Hunslet and Leeds in general. Could you sort of unpack that and introduce these characters for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so Norman is a retired sports coach that worked for the National Association of Lads Clubs, or it's called the National Association of Boys Clubs in real life. And he is an oral storyteller. He was never a professional writer, but he has always told stories to his family and his friends, and he's always written throughout his life. And at the point where we meet him, those stories have really become a thing of the past. He's sort of forgotten about them. He's going through dementia, and he's become an alcoholic again, as he was way back in his life. And Fred is a discontented man of 29, about to hit 30, who's worked a slew of jobs that he's hated. He currently covers very mundane stuff like traffic stories and regeneration projects for a newspaper in Nottingham. And his experience of the late capitalist world has depleted his creativity completely. So he is, I think of him as an everyman in a time in which the everyman is in a form of existential crisis. And as we find him, it's in Norman's, well, he's going to visit Norman, his granddad, in the summer of 2017, and he is trying to revive any sort of creativity he has by drawing upon his granddad's stories of the past and trying to revive them or tell them, retell them in his own way, whilst knowing that he can never stay true to the actual facts of Norman's stories, because chances are a lot of them are quite fabricated or fantasized, or certainly he can't figure out what is true and what is not. So there's always that anxiety that overhangs his project of retelling these stories throughout the book.
And I do love the juxtaposition as well, particularly in the idea of this very precarious. It is the everyman as a writer in a way. We're all quite, even as, you know, we're both writers, it's a very precarious aspect. And as he was reading out about the idea of the phone being a sweatshop, in a way, so much writing is data production now. It's dead labor. We're constantly making commodities. I mean, we're making one right now. I mean, it is a kind of an inescapable trap from which, even in a sort of theoretical setting, as you say, capital is too bloody clever. And one of the things I love about how you characterize Fred as well, particularly that there's not even the constant circulation of doing traffic, of reporting on traffic incidents, but also his job writing obituaries, which is writing, it's producing dead labor, producing data, but who's it producing about? It's about dead laborers, people who have been worn down by the very system itself. And they just, the contest about writing, I mean, it's a particularly poignant moment, not to give anything away for the listeners, where there's a competition about who owns a typewriter, which erupts in complete absolute sort of not manic, but unleashed hostility between, that say, forces of fascist reaction and forces of constantly precarious modern everyman workers, let's say. And it's, this theme of writing is probably one of the most interesting things, I think, to start off for exploration of the book, which is, to talk about, to ask about sort of the theme of writing and writing amongst something which Fred experiences as a crisis of creativity, which sort of, you know, permeates the present. And therefore, you know, he has to look back to Norman to see, you know, to try and maybe shift through the difference between mythology and history, and maybe even confront that difference. You know, the whole book is structured, mm-hmm. You know, so one chapter will be, you know, the Norman, one chapter will be Fred, and so on and so forth. Or sometimes it's Michael mm-hmm. and Norman. Again, how could he know? So this is this question of mythology, which is fully seeped in this. And so I wanted to ask about this idea of creativity, mm-hmm. and particularly about the creativity of writing in conversation with itself. I mean, to put it in sort of a question, you know, does writing have to return to its history in order to kind of launch itself out of a defeated and impotent present, given that the past is always already with us? It's never truly sort of past.
It's an interesting question. I think particularly working class writing does have to have a dialogue with history, because class consciousness has been so obliterated in the 21st century, or since the 90s, or the 80s even. I think it's working class writing more so than any other writing which has a duty to do that. And working class writers, not just myself, but others have been doing that in the recent, maybe the last 20 years. Years or so. I wrote on this for my dissertation, my master's dissertation last year, and it was about that shift between working class texts containing a hope for an end of history in the past, say pre-neoliberalism, and how in the last couple of decades the working class texts that seem to come out either are historical texts of some sort, or they're set in the past but they're novels, or their autobiographies about childhood, and all of which, you know, the main ones that I've seen tend to be set in the latter half of the 20th century. So I think that whether working class writers even intend on doing it or not, there is a dialogue there to be had with the past. And there's clearly a rupture point in the past that working class writers need to go back to, not to even revive or to reclaim something in a very broad term, but to go back and to reassess and to consider what has happened and why we've got to the point that we have. Of course, the working class have always been placed in a historical process pushing towards that achievement of an end of history. And now that we're in such a place of impotence and feeling defeated as a proletariat, there are really sort of no grand narratives to guide us anymore. And many writers will look back to the past, try and place themselves within that sort of tradition, within that lineage, because without that, how can you place yourself as a writer? You need something to lean up against or to learn from, or to continue, even if you're going to then break the mold of that writing, which I've tried to do to an extent here. I thought of this, of Cautious About a Drift, of being inspired just as much by postmodernism as it is by kitchen sink drama. It's sort of the merging. I like to think of those two genres. What would happen if the kitchen sink was rammed into by the postmodern? What would the result, the carnage of that collision look like? But of course, we cannot model ourselves on the past. It's about returning to it to rescue the vitally important from there, that being a more keenly felt sense of class consciousness, and using that to revive it, in which it is so painfully underrepresented.
I mean, there's a hovering question back in my mind now about postmodernism, but I'll bracket that for something more important here, which is the idea of working class writing. Because, I mean, in a way, in the abstract sense, someone could come up and say, well, we're in the golden age of working class writing because working class people are writing more than ever before. You know, everyone, the social demand for phones is more often, and every, as Richard Seymour likes to point out, every post is writing in a way. But that's not what people are going. It's not in the sense, you know, working class writing for itself. It's working class writing as production. It is labor fundamentally. It's writing has been subsumed to labor. And I totally agree that it's as in contrast to the ways in which, you know, certain sort of newspaper columnists will denounce the idea of writing. Say, for example, people sneering at, you know, sort of the working class poetry collection that was sort of introduced by Lynn McCluskey and Jeremy Corbyn. The idea of working class writing has always been kind of sneered at because fundamentally it's a break with writing as labor. It's writing as leisure, but also writing as something which suspends the production of value. And it's interesting way that I'd wonder to what extent there could be like Nathan Corbyn, I guess, is an exemplar of this, of essentially a kind of a political imperative to write, not in the sense of to post, because post is always expressing a platform, but a political imperative to write as a kind of leisure, I wonder. Because in a way, that whilst it is a golden age of working class people engaging in the acts of writing, this writing totally, you know, comes back in the form of dead labor. It depresses them. It's their capital in a way. It is, well, not their capital, it is capital. And I sometimes wonder if the printer strike had gone differently in Wapping, we might not be in the same hyper-real situation we are now. So I guess, and maybe this does bleed into the postmodern, and I guess to lead up into the postmodern question, it was very hard for me to ignore the presence of a certain Jean-Francois Lyotard being referenced in this book, as well as I do agree Heidegger is a wanker. I do agree with Fred on that, but Lyotard hovers, particularly in the, as you mentioned, as Fred mentions in the book, having read Le Binot Economy, this idea, which not necessarily, it is, you know, it's, well, Lyotard is Mr. Postmodern, the idea that the English working class, and people forget that he specifies the English working class, not only because it's in, probably because it's in Marx's text, but there's a pessimistic temptation here to say, well, it is just the English of, they enjoyed the anonymity. They enjoyed sort of being broken out of this restrictive kind of quasi-feudal community role. And then they enjoyed sort of having themselves torn asunder by Thatcherism. But, well, actually, no. You know, very close comparison. I'm not going to edit that out. But I wanted to ask, actually, if you can unpack this idea of the postmodern here, particularly as it comes to postmodernism, which is a genre so saturated with thinking about writing, and this idea of the working class writer as you explore it.
Yeah. I mean, in what I'm drawing on from postmodernism, I suppose I'm drawing on intertextuality. I think that intertextuality serves a vital role in this book because I do not believe that to write in a way, in quite a paradoxical way, I don't believe that to write a realistic novel in this current climate in 2022 in this country, you can lean into the realism that working class writing has enjoyed in the past, or the naturalism, because we are not in that world anymore. And because the world is completely dominated by, I mean, fake news, or that's, you know, the term being thrown about. And there are these constant forms of intertextuality which dominate our lives in some ways fine, in other ways can be troubling. It depends in whose hands they're being utilized. But I think that the world, because it is so confused nowadays, and because there are so many varying narratives vying for the attention of the reader or the public in general, to present the world as anything other than intertextuality would be doing that people feel in the modern world. So it's got to that point where what seems absurd or what seems fantastical has almost become the real. And again, that's why I mean a collision between kitchen sink drama, which tends to be very, very realistic. It prides itself on very similitude, even if that's not the case all the time, and something which is so the opposite of it, something which is so fantastical or has these range of possibilities. What happens when those two things come together?
It's especially good to highlight the aspect of fantasy in a sense of, the realism. It's not that realism is dead as a genre so much as realism is simply in a way, the material conditions of our society make, as you said, there's a tendency towards verisimilitude, but verifying everything is so much harder because the verification is no longer based in a kind of a necessarily like the bounds of a community norm. There are many common senses, or if there is one common sense, it's usually dictated by sort of the Murdoch colonist view of what an imagined, usually what imagined sort of working class figure ends up thinking. And so, yeah, I think particularly we talk about postmodern, the idea of intertextuality, there's this fundamental shift in writing and in self-conscious, but there's a question of salvage there, of recovering, or hauntology, I guess, if we want to go into the more Fisherian mode of it. And to that extent, there's a question as well, I think, about, so at one point during the reading, Fred says that, you know, am I nostalgic for the past? No. Am I hopeful for the future? Double no. And then just to go further on, the future once imagined in the times of our predecessors has already arrived, and now we see it for what it is. A detemporalized space, et cetera, et cetera. People can go back to the quote there, but there's a question of, that there's a lot of responses to the current predicament which tend to look back in nostalgia. And nostalgia can have, of course, emancipatory uses. There's been some interesting writing, Graft and Tanner, like that. But this is not a book which is nostalgic. Mm. But it seems to be more about, as I said, it's about being adrift. And so what does it mean to be adrift in this history without being nostalgic for it?
To be adrift is to notice the divorce. The divorce from any form of meaning or identity in the modern world, that's essentially what underlines Fred's mission throughout the book, is that he's looking for meaning, he's looking for a purpose. He feels like he never has had one because of this divorce that he's felt from the culture of the past, and that indeed even older characters, even Norman to an extent, now feels that divorce also. He's a socialist character and always has been, but he ends up in the late 80s marrying a woman who mistreats him and who is a representation of Thatcher, essentially. So in the act of trying to rectify that surrender or that inability to reach a common meaning or a common purpose, is to be adrift. And throughout the whole novel, Fred is trying to reach the land, I suppose, a land that exists very much in the mist of time, that he may never, well, he doesn't ever really reach it, but sort of circles it and tries to find a way in. But then, of course, there's the problem of, did that land ever really exist in the way that he thinks it did to begin with? When he meets, for instance, a friend of Norman's, an old friend, Ned, he meets him in the present, and Ned hasn't seen Norman in probably about 50 to 60 years. He hasn't seen him, and Ned somewhat remembers Norman, and he recalls him as if he's a character that he might have heard of in a story. It's that sense of collective amnesia that I think plights the modern, the 21st century working class, which points to not only the tendency of people to want to forget the past as perhaps a way of healing, but also underlines the necessity to go back there and deal with the inherent issues that have ruptured the past from the present.
And the idea of divorce as well, it reminded me of the C.S. Lewis story, The Great Divorce, the idea that the gates of hell were locked from the inside, in a sense of not wanting to remember this past, in the sense of, the conversation with Ned, Fred and Ned go back and forth, you know, like, were things better? Okay, yes, things less individualistic, but everyone was as poor as each other, and that gave them a sense of community struggles. They said, you know, you had to make, you didn't see a rich man, you had to go make an effort to rob them. And it's, this is happening as Fred's going this drunken wander throughout Leeds across the air, going to a place which, I mean, bloody hell, he pays £5.85 a pint, and if that's hit Leeds, that's if the rot has moved up from London, then my God, things have gotten bad. But then luckily he touches down upon what he thinks is, yeah, I said this land that the lads club, the working men's club, where you can get a £2 pint of Tuborg, which are nice as well, because you mentioned in the, you know, you write that he pays £5.85 for a Danish IPA, explicitly Danish. He says it just says Danish IPA, and then he goes to the working men's club and he pays under half the price, but the beer's still Danish. And so there's that lingering question of it was always ever a little bit globalized. There was always international commerce, but there was this kind of barrier. Mm. And as someone who's, I mean, there are some sort of social clubs still around in sort of, I mean, so I originally come from Dagenham, and there's still a couple social clubs. Some of them have tended, I don't know if they were always conservative clubs, but, or maybe some of them have switched, but they are very much an incredibly decreasing affair. And it's kind of a shame, really. I always thought that music scenes would be a lot healthier as well, I think, if these were still existing. Not only in the sense that there's more venues, but in the sense of there's community control over them. I mean, there's someone who does a lot for black metal, big fascist problem. If we had more community control of venues, there wouldn't be such a profit imperative, for example, to just, you couldn't say no to some of these bands because it'd be going to draw a crowd. But I just wanted to ask a bit more about this aspect of sort of the lads club. So I know you did a lot of research in this, and also looking back to family as experience as well. Could you go into the research of this novel a bit more and just talk about this coinciding of working class history, the personal and the political, but particularly through this idea of the lads club or the boys club, which some listeners may have a notion of, but it may just be particularly for non-British listeners, the image of the Smiths standing outside Salford Boys Club, the iconic one.
I mean, you make a good point with the fact that quite a few have become conservative clubs. I've noticed that certainly all over the place, wherever I am in the Midlands or in the North or in London as well. But those places, particularly, the Holbeck Working Men's Club and the Hunslet Boys Club, which is now the Hunslet Youth Club, were family haunts. So that was where my granddad actually did work as a sports coach for a while, and he moved around to a few different boys clubs, but that's where he started off teaching football and boxing and stuff like that. So when I did go up there and had a chat with the fellow that runs the place up there, what I found was that there are still these little pockets of working class community where, even in quite a sterilized land compared to what Hunslet once was, the same things are going on, the same sort of oral storytelling, the same neighborliness does remain to a point, but it's taken a massive hit. I mean, that area, this was maybe 2 years ago, I went up there to research it, but that area is going to have far more sort of luxury flats built on it. All of that sort of thing, big wave of gentrification is going to hit that area because it's only maybe a couple of miles south of Leeds, probably going to have to move from where it is now and go to a completely different area a little bit further out in Leeds, which is going to be such a massive blow for the community who have been there. I think they moved to that site in the 60s or 70s, but there's still that family lineage there, in that people are going with their kids, and they used to go when they were kids, the parents, and then the grandparents used to go. And it's that localism of the working class community. Of course, it might be a bit of a cliche, but it certainly is true in a lot of places that there is real localism, and people defend each other in their communities, and they really hold pride in their community, even though it, somewhere like Hunslet, has been constantly knocked down and reshaped and built over, and there's been slum clearances. People have still stayed there, and they've still welcomed, for the most part, newcomers in as neighbours and shared solidarity with them. But as is the case with so many places like this, at the moment they are facing really being turfed out and sent to the further reaches of the city, as you're getting in London at the moment. So that was a real eye-opener going there. With research elsewhere, I mean, what was nice about this is Fred isn't me, I'm not Fred, but his research in the novel is pretty spot on in terms of the research that I was doing when I was actually writing it, going to the library and sitting down looking through these books about industry, I suppose, and trying to find work which would actually tell me about the common lives of the actual ordinary people. And all of the records were about who owned the factories or who was a sort of more official professional figures, all of them very well documented. All of the workers are very much anonymized. In a lot of these books, like, you just see their hands working at the machine rather than seeing their faces. Or, of course, there's no names there. So I was asking at the library, is there anything more along the lines of common history of these people? And there wasn't really anything. Of course, Richard Hoggart's uses of literacy. Richard Hoggart is from Hunslet, and he talks very well about people in that community, but also all over the country. So that's really the closest thing that there is. But the absolute void of that sort of history pointed to the need to really unearth these occulted remnants of the past, these occulted histories that are suffering in the wake of this collective amnesia. And largely, I mean, even the working class half the time don't want to tell them because there's a shame of this collapsed project of Marxism, or this collapsed project of the end of history. But such stories can't be brushed under the rug because they make up the fabric of history. History is, or has been, such an important thing to the working class. So to let that go would be to really surrender to the severing of the past from the future, and to surrender to the obliteration of class consciousness, essentially.
I think there's loads of amazing images in which you explore just this in the book as well, particularly the figure of the literal hand. You know, there's a character, for instance, Taylor's a character whose hand is lost in industrial accident, and they lost it, you know, fighting like 10 or 15 Nazis at once, and so they can't be, so that therefore then that gives them kind of a shield against mockery from the local kids who go and call them sort of Captain Hook, and now it becomes captain, become a war hero, and sort of the shame of the industrial and the shame of, it's very Protestant kind of guilt, even if you don't have to be Protestant, it's a cultural kind of guilt there, that you've in a sense had this lot, you've kind of been predestined rather than something misfortunate. And the figure of the hand, the idea is that, you know, you either put in a myth to avoid the shame, or simply you try to ignore it, and then who fills that narrative void, because there is still always going to be a desire for that gap, which actually, this is why Norman's such a fascinating character. He's, you know, you see in his bookshelf, he has the condition of the working class in England. He has Down and Out in Paris and London, I think. He has Homage to Catalonia. And so I'm completely missing the poor man's bookshelf here. And this, the figure of working class is not necessarily sort of, I mean, the book does it well, particularly in terms of the image. It is the image, the hand, I think, believe literally haunts Fred or even Norman in a dream at one point. And it's this idea of severing. I mean, the very fact of, despite the fact that, you know, working class, well, industrial accidents are always reported, they're always reported on the side of the boss. I think the only example I've ever seen in popular culture of a work as like an actual foundational injury, or an industrial injury coming up into the forefront of public consciousness, was, it's a very weird example, it's the guitarist of Black Sabbath, Tony Iommi. He lost his fingertips in he worked in a steel mill, And I think that's the only time I've ever heard of an industrial accent being described, being talked about commonplace in these sort of cultural circles. And that's why he had to famously get to melt down a fairy liquid bottle to make plastic mold fingertips so he could play guitar, but it was still painful, so he had to lower the tuning, and bam, we get heavy metal, and now there's a statue of him and the others on a fucking bridge in Birmingham. Now that's an industrial horror story about labor relations, but it's been converted because of the narrative has been so lost into this, if anything, retroactive justification, because it's given us all this cool stuff. It's given us this enjoyment, and yet the fundamental sociological roots of it has been completely forgotten. I mean, this is kind of true of almost all of the sort of Birmingham metal scene. The example with the lovely counterexample of someone like Napalm Death, but it's not necessarily as easy to hear what they're saying about labor relations through all of the screaming. So this aspect of amnesia. I mean, is amnesia? Why amnesia? In a sense, or people want to forget? Is it like an active amnesia, or is it more a political murder of memory, or is it something? Is it both? Is it this dual motion of wanting to forget, exemplified in the idea of alcoholism, maybe, and also this murder of the working class, especially the idea of workers' schools, strike schools, which have completely faded from memory.
I think it's both. It's definitely a mixture of both, but I think it's also a natural process of when the role of the individual or the culture of the individual is being stressed so much as it is today. There is no room really to share that collective memory, and with the decimation of industry, for instance, the people that were working together and had a common thing that they would benefit from, that they shared, which would be to, you know, improve their lot in these particular industries and maintain their family lineage in these industries. There was some purpose for them to have a common story and to stay true to that because it was so important. When you take away all the props and the landscapes that uphold that common lineage and that common purpose, I think memory just tends to fade with it, in the sense that people will still want that, but it will be buried. And a lot of people as well, people that are working class, buy into capitalism quite happily. There's a tendency, I mean, I talk about this when Fred goes to meet Ned. Of course, Ned, who was working class, who's come from Hunslet, and his dad works with the locomotives, etc., and he's climbed his way up through industry a bit. At the end, he ends up becoming a Thatcherite and going completely against the trade union movement of the 70s and the 80s, and embracing capitalism, even though it has bought him very little. He's got his council house that he bought in the 80s, and he just sort of haunts the working men's club every single day, as he has done for however many decades on end. But for people like that as well, I think there's a tendency to forget that the working class hasn't always been homogeneous, or it wasn't homogeneous at all times in the past. There were always outliers, and there were always people that were going to try and put themselves or their interests above those of those that they were around, those in the community. And I think with the empowerment of that ideology, naturally more and more people have swung to it. And that's why, I mean, you go to a working class area in this country at the moment, half the people I grew up with had no clue what socialism was or what Marxism was, certainly. And a lot of them got indoctrinated by the right wing or the far right, even further on the spectrum. And I talk up that is, yeah, it's a reaction in the community to the enforcement of forgetting. And in that process, people actively do forget, because at the end of the day, the Marxist project or the end of history project was defeated by neoliberalism. And there seems to be perhaps a bit of a swell of it again, nowhere near as strong as it once was. But there is a swell of collective solidarity going on at the moment with the strikes that are happening across different public sector industries. But I think we're just reconnecting to that memory again now, out of absolute necessity with the cost of living crisis. Whereas up until this point in time, certainly when I was writing the book, those memories were completely dormant. They'd been completely gotten rid of, and I didn't really think that there was anyone that cared to rescue them.
Thinking as well about sort of the resurgence of this collective kind of agency it always feels kind of it's material, it's not miraculous, but it feels miraculous in a way, because it kind of is born out of a material necessity of, well, everything is gradually pushing. It's not that our individualism is being deactivated, but rather circumstances literally push us together. The bounds of the atomization cannot hold. And I think absolutely going back to this idea of create kind of an amnesia. I mean, if you've been fully individualized and you want to try and still have this sort of idea of this, what the Marxist meta-narrative or the idea of the end of history, which you, not as a working class, but as a worker, is now to fulfill, fucking hell, you're gonna want to drink. And actually, no, let's drink and forget about this, because it's an individualized idea of, oh, I have now got to join up with everyone and fulfill the end of history. Oh God, no, I'm too atomized. I can't find it. I don't have a sense that I'm doing it with anyone else. And therefore it's a very depressing thing to take upon the whole burden of history to oneself there. And so this the conditions, I think, definitely are rising, this new kind of collective agency, especially when you have someone like Mick Lynch. It could have been a strike, because it's very individualistic and least level of the individual sector. But no, you've got him saying stuff like, no one is illegal. You've got, in a way, an ideological or a consciousness of collectivity, which even breaks the bounds of the imposed legal limits on striking. I mean, the idea that sympathy strikes, you know, just for the listeners, like secondary action. So one, for example, I mean, in the States, we have a great example of this with the SAG after strike going and strike on behalf of not only themselves, but also in support of the writers. I mean, God, that was probably the best move that the enemy kind of have made, to make sure that, you know, train drivers couldn't go on strike in behalf of nurses. It kind of atomized even the unions into individual singular entities. Of course, they keep fucking up. For example, there's a lot of sectors that are not necessarily linked, but are engaged by the same unions now. But I really love how the struggle of individuality in circumstances that require collective action just constantly permeate through the narrative here. And of course, you already mentioned Small Man's England, but I'd like to bring it back to the idea of England, because the theme is, I mean, this is a quote from the book here, hegemonic as always, England, hegemonic as always, conquered everyone in the end. It's a place where, I'm going to quote again, because this is a lovely line, the wicked could be seen whenever you took your bins out, and you would yawn at the sight of it. And there's a great one even later when Fred recalls, his dad and sort of a fatherless boy, England awaits them at the end of every evening. And so, I mean, England doesn't just haunt this book. It is, in a way, kind of, to use a sort of term from sort of structuralist Marxism, in the last instance, England is there to collect you, even if you're trying to resist its hegemonic capitalist forces. I mean, this is definitely the case, not only through how you talk about the characters, sort of who always grown up in Leeds, but also the McLaughlin family who come over from Ireland to escape the troubles there. And so how does the idea of England function for you in this book? And would you say that to what degree of continuity would you put between A Small Man's England and A Cautious Boat Adrift?
There's definitely continuity. I think that whatever I write, England or the idea of Englishness plays a role in it, because the lived reality of the characters that I write about is often an English one. I think it's almost inescapable for my writing. I think that nationality is also inescapable for most writers, even if they're writing about countries other than where they've grown up. There is still that lingering influence of nationality or a national idea or a national point of view. And it's certainly there for me. I mean, when I, in A Small Man's England, I say towards the end that when I when I think of England, I think of the working class. And what I mean by that is that I believe England to be the sum of the common people that live here, the sum of the working class people, rather than necessarily the partner of the corrupt state or whatever corrupt state may be in place at the time. But England is such a nuanced entity in that its history, again, can't be avoided. And the history of England, as has been used by the state, has been a history of the state against the working class and against the people that I am trying my best to represent or to certainly write about in this book. So there's always going to be that conflict there. And it's also bearing in mind that these characters inhabit an England which has essentially one, or thinks that it's one, memories, and in terms of their sense of self, that they're living in the ruins of an England that could have been had they had more success with winning a socialist radical future. So they're living in the aftermath of the England that they had dreamt for, and in its nightmarish aftermath. I think similarly to A Small Man's England, Cautious Boat Adrift also follows a dreamscape, or it's more obviously a dreamscape in A Small Man's England than it is in Cautious Boat Adrift, maybe. But again, there are these ideas or these imagined worlds which the protagonist creates in A Small Man's England. It's George, who is multiple different characters all at the same time, but is also a representation of St. George. And in this one, the imagined worlds are those of Fred and of Norman. But even these imagined worlds in which escapism is meant to be possible because you're reaching the emotional plane of storytelling, and I call stories in the novel these unmanufactural utopias of the non-place. Stories are meant to inhabit a sort of nowhere realm between the something and the nothing. Even when the characters are trying to go there, those stories still stay rooted in England. They're still bleakly familiar at times, as well as sometimes fantastical and occupying the ocean, for instance. But even then, they're tied to England because it's the North Sea, or it's the very coast of England. So these characters can't quite escape. I mean, I named the family, the main family in the novel, the Whitbys, after the coastal town, because I think that they teeter at the edge of England. And they're constantly looking out to what is beyond England. They're a stone's throw from the ocean, which is this massive site of infinite possibilities and mysteries and things that can never be known. And in that way, it is similar to the function of storytelling, in that storytelling allows you to explore these impossibilities and these fantastical scenarios, and it allows that escapism from the land and from everything that can be implemented on the land and how the land can weigh you down. So they're constantly at the circumference or at the verge of this reaching the unknowable and possibly the utopian, but never able to get there in the long run, or only able to get there through escapism.
I really love the use of the ocean as a kind of as a utopian image, because the history of philosophy, particularly bourgeois philosophy, has always seen the ocean as a kind of a threat, unless it is used for commerce. When Kant, Kant's sort of the father of modern European philosophy, the ocean is where you don't want to be. You want to be on an island, and if something has to go across, the ocean is the place of dialectical illusion. You go beyond the limits of ordered experience, and the only point of going out onto the ocean is to come back to where you started and realize how lovely it is, or how you're safe here, how you don't, there's meant to be no escape. The point is to instill a discipline in the reader that they will not want to even leave. They'll take you out into the ocean, essentially tell you how horrible it is, or to tell you how unrealizable it is. I wouldn't say it's hopeless, because Kant is a writer about hope, but it's not a philosophical or intellectual hope. It's more of a practical hope. But by the time you've already got past that, where is the imagination there? And so I really love the figure of the ocean here. The ocean, and I did wonder about Whitby, particularly as well. I don't know, for me, it also came to the image of Dracula as well, because where does Dracula land to extract surplus value from the necks of the English working class? It is ultimately Whitby. And this idea of the English, or England itself, as this sum of all of its parts which it can hopefully integrate, you know, the parts of the working class, the part as the working class. I think that's a really fantastic idea of just thinking about even the ideas of, you know, the utopias that never realized, going back to the English Civil War with Gerard Wyn Stanley, the earth as a common treasury for all, a kind of an unbounded England that is not bound by the property that sort of, you know, it's original sin, I guess, to use a term which he may have been inclined to use. Or even, I mean, maybe this is telling that our dreams for a better England keep getting more and more reduced, or even more and more moderate in a way, and yet still get treated as if they're apocalyptic, world-destroying things, even in 2019. There's an extent in which we're sort of being reminded that we were in the ruins of, to use a phrase, you know, Owen Haverley, the new ruins of Great Britain, not only architecturally, because the houses are mostly mould and dying from underinvestment, or simply by being built for being stores of nothing else but value, or just all the just shit and not maintained properly, but also the ruins of, we wasn't asking for much in 2019, comparatively speaking. You know, from Wyn Stanley to Scargill, you can see that, okay, communism or socialism, good. Corbyn, it's, can things work a little bit, please? It may be, you know, out of a safety net, there's a slightly more petty bourgeois inflection, maybe, of fulfill some of the promises of social mobility ideology, and even that was treated as if, but we should have bloody asked for communism. We were treated like we was asking for it anyway, in a way. So I think this idea of England as the sum of all these parts is, it's a way of rescuing. I mean, does that maintain a degree of nationality, though? Is the nationality, does that mean, by treating England this way, do we have to reformulate the nation as a kind of minor history, as a history of the excluded part, which the whole nonetheless presupposes? Does that become an inversion of the nation, or does that become the nation's presupposition, its condition and shadow, which it can never truly extricate?
I think that to reimagine the nation, I mean, the point that I'm making, a small man's England, is to get rid of this shadow of what the term a small man's England means, one that is atavistic, which is jingoistic, which draws upon nostalgia in a very negative political sense, which is often tied in with racism, and often tied in with the far right, and that is the way that I see a lot of working class, white working class men, is what the book's about, have been swept up by. And what I'm calling for in A Small Man's England is the creation of a common England, which is one that recognises a common history, one which is built by, necessarily, and for the common people of all demographics. And I think that being able to create that narrative of what England is and take it away from the hands of the bourgeoisie and the hands of the ruling classes and the political classes is the first step in creating that, because a common England would have to be one which is DIY, which would have to start within communities and be built from the ground up over years and years and years, until the idea of what it means to be English, or what it means to be in England, is so different from what the political class can push forward, that, you know, hopefully the election of a progressive, if not an outright radical or socialist party, would seem like common sense. But until that idea, that narrative of what England is or could be, based on working class community and solidarity, until that point, we're doomed, I think, to repeat the same sort of cycle, unless it gets to a point of absolute sheer desperation, as we're marching towards now, in which even the middle classes or the traditional middle classes are starting to be affected by a cost of living crisis, at which point it's more likely to snap than it's if it's just those that have always been working class making these demands. So, yeah, no, absolutely. The idea of the nation needs to be reformed, and it's a mammoth task, of course, considering what a bastard England can be and has certainly been. But it's a necessary task unless we want to absolutely surrender place and purpose and sense of self in some cases to the sort of to the victors. Political victors and those that have always fought England was theirs. It's not theirs. And the point of that is to take it back from them. And I think to an extent that continues, that idea continues over in Cautious About Adrift as well.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And so Billy Bragg, mate, no, we are looking for a new England. We do want to change the world. Tommy, thank you so much for coming on. What are you working? Are you currently working on anything at the moment? Any projects? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I am. Well, I'm working on another novel at the moment. It's early draft at the moment, but we'll see how we go with that. I've got a play on in the Broccoli Jack Theatre in August, at the end of August, and I'll be putting out a new issue of the magazine that I edit, Grass, in the next couple of months, and that is all working class literature, photography, art. So lots of things coming up, but I can be found all over the gaff, really. If you type in Tommy Sissons, you'll find me. Twitter, Tommy Fred Sissons is my Instagram. Thank you for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. So, folks, you can now buy Cautious, A Boat Adrift at Repeater and all good bookstores, and possibly even some bad ones like Amazon, because that's the world we live in, I guess. But also, A Small Man's England, available from all good and that one bad store. Tommy, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll catch everyone later.
We appreciate your support of the imprint and the channel. Subscribe to Zero Books Today on Patreon. Your material support helps us to promote a variety of perspectives on the left. Also, discover the many titles, new and old, that Zero has curated. Navigate to any of the links in the show notes to extend your support.